Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown, out there on the edge of the prairie. It's that beautiful time of year, blue skies, a little chill in the air, and all these leaves on the ground. If you want to interact with leaves, this is a beautiful time if you're a child to be able to walk along and kick them and watch their patterns as they fly, to gather them together into a pile, to burrow down into them, to swim in leaves, to feel them all around you. Such a great feeling. Back in the day, you know, when kids just used to hang around. I saw a kid in St. Paul the other day. He was just walking along kicking leaves. It seems so odd to me. You hardly ever see kids out on the streets or in parks, because they're scheduled, they're organized. We've organized their lives. They have lessons, and they have practice, and they're out for teams, and they're doing all these things. And then they have to go into therapy as a result of all these things that we've organized for them. And so our streets, even streets in neighborhoods that have a lot of children, tend to be sort of bare. You look at all of these unkicked leaves, these unpiled leaves. Back in the day, we used to just hang out. We led this sort of dreamy life. We walked around thinking our own thoughts. We had the benefit of boredom. We had the benefit of just hanging out with nothing to do. Sometimes I would play football with other boys, and that was fun. It was sort of fun. It was supposed to be fun, and you tried to make it fun. Some boys had pads and helmets. Other boys did not. Theoretically, it was fun. And you kept thinking to yourself, this should be fun. But we had an argument about whether you could fall on somebody after they were already down on the ground. See, this was two-hand touch, which turned into tackle. And that was fine, but there were these big boys, and they were always late coming up to the play, and they liked to just dive onto people and crush them. And some smaller boys got dove on and lay there weeping, which is a terrible humiliation when you're 11 years old. And we were arguing about whether this was right or not. And some of us said it was not right. You shouldn't pile on somebody when they're on the ground. And the big boy said, well, what are you going to do about it? Well, what I did about it was to walk away. That's what I did. I just walked away, and I walked around town, and I kicked leaves, and I thought my own thoughts, and I walked up to the cemetery, which I really loved. It was quiet up there, especially around dusk and just after dusk, and you could go up and commune with those people who were up there and wonder who they were and see these little tombstones of children with little lambs on them. And the Rosenquist girl, Rosemary Rosenquist, I thought about, because she had died when she was just 10, which was the age I was back then. And there was a little poem on her tombstone, although she was only 10 years old, but she had died about 12 years before. She was one of those blue babies, they said, had heart congestion. Shed not for her the bitter tear, nor give your heart to vain regret. 'Tis but a coffin that lies here. The gem that filled it sparkles yet. That was the poem on her tombstone. I wondered what it would be like being down there, just having to lie still all those years. And then I moved on and walked on to do other things. I didn't care for Halloween all that much. Other people dressed up and seemed to have a wonderful time. I thought to myself, this ought to be fun. One could try to make it fun. I didn't quite know how to do it. The Catholics back in those days did not go in for costume parties. Father Emil was dead set against it, and then he sort of lost track of things towards the end of his regime. And Sister Arvon, who had always loved dressing up and believed that children should be encouraged to do this, she put on these parties. He was oblivious. He was up there in his attic room. He was studying the Civil War, going over maps and going over battle reports. It just fascinated him, these battles, how close it was, armies lost in the dark, trying to figure out where each other was men on horseback riding around trying to locate people, men holding up kerosene lamps over maps trying to figure out where they were, and they weren't sure half of the time. The Battle of Chickamauga in the fall of 1863 near Chattanooga, Tennessee. And General Rosecrans, the Union forces had the advantage. They always had the advantage, the blue. But the gray fought back under this terrible general, Braxton Bragg, who was just as awful as his name suggested. Father Emil up there poring over these things, these armies circling each other. And then the gap in the Union ranks where General Longstreet's troops managed to break in and win the battle, but not decisively. It was just sort of a tactical victory. Meanwhile, Sister Arvon is back in the school organizing children who are goblins and zombies and devils and demons and witches, all of this evil on hand. She tries to do this every year and get this past Father Wilmer, who replaced Father Emil years ago, although some people still think of Father Emil and remind Father Wilmer of it, including Sister Arvon. She said children ought to be able to come to church and have a good time and associate church with a good time and not just sit and listen to long, grim sermons. A slap in the face. He turned the other cheek. She said, Father Emil didn't object to this. Not exactly true. She said, perhaps you should dress up, she said. You could be a space alien, she said. Or you could be a clown. She was talking to him. There were third graders standing right behind her. She brought out from her pocket a little red sponge nose with a slit in it. She handed it to him, not wanting to seem like a poor sport. He put it on. He was alarmed at how the children laughed. They laughed long and hard at their priest. She said, here's a wig for you. Put this on. They've had this feud, Sister Arvon and Father Wilmer, for a long time, over all sorts of things. He was saying Mass one Saturday evening, this was almost a year ago, when he was having trouble with the sound system. And he said, there's something wrong with this mic. And she said, and also with you. She claimed not to have heard what he said. But he thought otherwise. I avoided these things. I love to walk around by myself, especially this time of year in dim light, and look at people, just watch them from a distance. I was just taking notes, just trying to remember. The Rosenquists, whose little girl had died 10 years before, they were interesting to me. Here they were, a couple, and they had no children. What an odd idea. Two people without a child. What did they do with their time? I was curious. They lived in a newer house way off towards the edge of town. It was a little rambler, and it had a picture window. And when the sun went down early, you could walk into their front yard, and there they were, sitting on the couch right in front of the picture window. I figured since it's called a picture window, you're supposed to look at it, no? So I crouched down there behind these little bushes, and I watched them sitting on the couch. She sat at one end, and he sat at the other. They were watching TV, two people without a child. I wanted them to do something. I wanted him to put his arms around her or to sing her a song or something. They were like paper dolls. I wanted to pick them up and move them around the room and make them say things and move their arms and legs. They just sat there. He was watching TV and she was reading a book. I wanted him to jump up and throw her down on the floor and lie on top of her. I wanted... I wanted things to, I wanted action, not just for them to sit there. I was patient. I waited. One night the phone rang, and she went into the kitchen to answer it. And when she disappeared, he reached down under the cushion, and he pulled out a magazine I had never seen before. And there was something about the cover of the magazine that suggested that it never would have been in our house. He was thinking bad thoughts, just as I had. I thought I was the only one, but here he was. He was looking through it and looking at pictures in it. And then he put his index finger up his left nostril, and he fished around up there. I thought I was the only one who did that, but here he was. And he pulled out something, and he was studying it and rolling it around in his fingers. How interesting people are when they don't know you're watching them. And then he heard her coming, and he wiped it off on the magazine and stuck the magazine back in under the cushion. Well, that's interesting, I thought. That's interesting. I watched them for a while longer, and they didn't do anything more that evening. I came back and watched them again the next night and the night after that. He was a quiet man. He taught geography in the high school. He was a quiet man. I imagined him as a murderer. I'd seen him once get into his car with a gun, so I imagined him going off and just shooting people. Golfers, perhaps. And dragging their bodies back, putting them in a trunk somewhere. I just was trying to invent a story about him so I would understand him better. It was mid-October, late October. I walked down that way, and nobody seemed to be at home. And then I saw his car was not in the garage, and she was out in the garden in back. She was looking at pumpkins. I slipped in the front door of their house, unlocked, of course. I'd never been inside it before. How fascinating to see other people's furniture and to see their plates and cups. How different they are from yours. How fancier they are. How neat a house is that has no children in it. The books on their shelves, what interesting things they read. And then I suddenly remembered this magazine under the cushion. I lifted up the cushion. There it was. It still had stuff on it. I don't know why I did this. I'm not proud of doing this, but I pulled it out and I lay it on the floor, and then I left. I went and I hid across the street behind the incinerator beside the garage of the Hansons' house. And I watched her as she came into the house. She was in the kitchen for a while. And then I couldn't see where she was. And I walked over into their yard. And I walked over to the side of their house. And I looked in the side of her house. And there she was. She had just come into the living room. And she saw it on the floor. And then I felt a hand on my shoulder. It was Mr. Rosenquist. He said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're looking in our house." I said, "I thought I saw somebody go in there and I didn't know who it was." "Well, who do you think it was?" he said. "I don't know," I said. "There have been Jehovah's Witnesses around. They might have gone in." And then he heard her call his name. And he could tell by the sound of her voice that he was in very serious trouble. He walked into the house and left me there. I watched. She was reading him the riot act. All of the things he had done, she listed them all in great detail. I was so grateful to get this whole catalog of misbehavior. He stalked out, and he got into his car, and he drove away, and he didn't come back for a couple of hours. It was dark. He came back. Their house was dark. I was across the street watching. I expected to hear a gunshot. I didn't hear one. It was a couple of weeks later, right around Halloween, a couple of days before Halloween, I was lying in bed at night, and there was someone in the room with me. It was a girl. It was a young girl. She just stood there. I could hear her breathing. She didn't say anything, but I could smell her fragrance. And then I saw her Halloween night. A whole string of trick-or-treaters came by. And then it was over, and we turned out the porch light, and we sat on the floor in the living room looking through our candy. And then I heard footsteps on the porch, bare feet. I opened up the door, and there she was. She had straight brown hair tied up in braids. She was slightly pigeon-toed. She looked at me, and she said, "Leave them in peace." She said it so quietly, I couldn't even be sure that was what she said, but I thought it was what she said. I said, "What?" She said, "Come with me, and I'll show you things you've never seen before." Well, there was a lot I hadn't seen. Most things, probably. I wasn't sure I was that anxious to see them. I wasn't sure what they might be. She said it again, "Come with me, and I'll show you things you've never seen." I never loved home so much. My room, my yard, my little town, as that moment when she walked away, bare feet across the porch and vanished out into the dark, out into Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong and all the men are good-looking and all the children are above average.